This week on The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
The push to have bigger families and more babies is part of a movement called pronatalism. They are freaking out about declining global fertility rates. And that is real. It's a phenomenon called birth dearth. What's behind this push to start a new baby boom? Who are the voices pushing for a more pro-family America? And what exactly does that mean?
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, streaming now on your favorite podcast app.
At call centers in the Philippines, AI isn't taking people's jobs, but it is monitoring their every word.
Without AI, you have that flexibility to be a human being. AI doesn't care how you're doing today.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, a check-in on those workers. And in China, a university student has been expelled because of who she appears to be dating. That has caused an uproar.
Women are viewed as property of men. Women viewed as property of the state.
Plus, in the UK, concert ticket scalpers are driving up prices for Oasis shows. And the Prime Minister brought it up in Parliament.
From what I've determined, about half the country is probably queuing for tickets over the weekend.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It is part of just about every conversation these days, AI, and it's often about how it might affect our jobs. Today, we start the show in the Philippines with an on-the-ground look at how AI is impacting call center workers. There are many of them in the Philippines. It's a big part of the economy. And so far, the workers our reporter Patrick Nguyen talked to still do have their jobs, but AI is making those jobs a lot harder.
When you hear this, you're probably not having the best day.
This call may be monitored or recorded for quality assurance or training purposes.
Your internet router is blinking red, your credit card won't work, something is screwed up, and a call center worker like Renzo Bahala has to fix it.
Everyone who calls in to us has a problem. If they don't have any problem, they'll not be contacting us in the first place.
Bahala is 21. He's worked in warehouse-sized call centers in the dead of night, when most of the Philippines is asleep, but America is awake. For much of his career, Bahala has taken calls from frustrated customers of a major U.S. bank.
This job is really stressful. We do get a lot of stuff, sometimes racist, sometimes they're shouting at us.
But it doesn't matter what people throw at him. He's got to keep things upbeat.
We need to practice saying positive words like great, perfect, wonderful.
Someone, actually something, is always listening and judging. Until recently, there were human beings inside the call center listening to random snippets of calls. That's what that "this call is recorded for quality assurance" thing is all about. A quality assurance team made sure workers like Bahala were on point, but they could only listen to a fraction of calls. Now, AI software does that job, and it does not miss anything.
Our every move are being watched by the management. AI is measuring both the pitch and tone of the call center agent and the customer as well.
Yep, pitch and tone. The AI even reports that to management. In the past few years, a range of new AI products have hit call centers. They have names like Call Miner, Verint, Akira. One named Kajito pitches their AI tool as a helpful coach for customer service agents.
And with Kajito's human-centered AI, every agent's coaching experience is dynamically optimized to enhance their skills and performance in the moment.
Most call center workers say AI software is less of a coach and more like a tireless overseer with zero empathy. Before, tiny mistakes might go unnoticed. But now, if the worker mispronounced a word, did they stutter, did they yawn, demerit, demerit, demerit. And too many demerits leads to probation, or worse.
It's a reason for management to terminate you.
That's Ian Porquia. He's a founding member of the BPO Industry Employees Network, which promotes the rights of call center employees.
Without AI, you have that flexibility to be a human being. If you commit a mistake, there's always an opportunity to correct that later on. But with AI, it doesn't care how you're doing today.
Porquia says call center workers in the Philippines aren't always doing so great. The pay is low, about $1,000 a month, and it's repetitive. And they keep vampire hours.
Our body clocks are upside down. You're about to start your shift at 8 p.m. because you have U.S.-based customers, and then you won't be able to stand up until the end of the shift because the call just comes in all day long.
Many callers are nice, but many are not. Porquia says staying professional, no matter what, is part of the job. But this micro-analysis of the call center worker's mood, he says that's a step too far.
Despite all the curses, they still need to sound happy on the phone. AI is able to capture the tone, and if you sounded sad, that call is a failure.
What really ticks off workers is that the AI penalizes them for not calming down an angry caller. Renzo Bahala says even that could lead to a dreaded bad score.
Every call has a score. Then it will average a score per day on your 8-hour shift, and that's every day.
Workers are also scored on other things outside their control. The AI wants them to wrap up the call in 5 minutes. But what if the caller won't stop yapping? Or what if the customer is angry because they don't want to speak to a foreigner? Bahala says that's very common.
Yeah, we do get a lot of things like that. They wanted to speak with a native English speaker. They are complaining that they don't understand us.
Believe it or not, AI has a solution for that. Sanas is a new AI product. Here's an online product demo featuring a man named Iggy. First, he speaks in his normal accent.
Hello, I'm Iggy. I'm from the Philippines. I'm into sports. I play tennis, basketball. I play the
And here's Iggy, filtered through an AI software to make him sound more American.
I'm Iggy. I'm from the Philippines. I'm into sports. I play tennis, basketball. I play the occasional golf game.
Renzo Bahala thinks the call center sector in the Philippines, making more than $30 billion a year, would love to remove human beings from the equation completely.
We are still in the early stages of AI. In the next 10 years, AI will be replacing our jobs.
If not sooner than that. In the meantime, Bahala says, please try to be nice to your call center agents. Their paycheck depends on it. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
A Chinese university recently announced that it expelled a student for allegedly dating a foreigner, or at least having what the university calls improper interactions. The story has sparked lively discussion on Chinese social media. Yacho Wang is a Chinese human rights researcher based in Washington. She says the student was expelled after a Ukrainian gamer posted photos on social media showing the two of them together.
Then because of this posting, the university made an announcement saying the female student will be expelled for engaging in this interaction with the Ukrainian game player. And the reason was given was that he damaged the reputation of the university and the dignity of the country.
So this was a Ukrainian gamer, as you said, who I believe was in the country in China for a gaming convention. What does the university mean by what they said about damaging the national dignity?
As a Chinese researcher following women's rights issues in China for over the years, this doesn't surprise me at all. I think it comes down to racism, nationalism, and sexism. Chinese women should only marry, have children with Chinese men to propagate the Chinese line. So this is racism. This is nationalism. On the other hand, you know, you never see a story of a Chinese man marrying a foreign woman and then the man being shamed. That kind of idea of Chinese man marrying foreign women is often being promoted and, you know, admired. Women are viewed as property of men. Women viewed as property of the state.
Is this official government policy that Chinese women should not be in relationships with foreign men?
I don't think it's explicit policy, but often through Chinese government propaganda, you can see that Chinese government make those announcements saying, you know, you need to be careful of talking to tall and handsome foreign men. They could be spies. And then there are those posters with a Chinese woman with a blonde guy. The implication is that Chinese women should not talk to foreign men, should not engage with foreign men. It's never the other way around. They wouldn't have any kind of propaganda sending the message Chinese men shouldn't interact with foreign women.
Some of that propaganda, at least, is framed around national security, saying that, you know, a Chinese woman could fall into a relationship with a foreign man who ends up being a spy and accidentally spill national secrets. Do you think that that a national security concern is actually what is behind this?
I don't think so. There is a national security concern in terms of foreigners who is soliciting information from a Chinese national that concerns national security. There is the concern. That concern from the Chinese government's aspect is legitimate. But what happens is, in reality, the information is solicited from Chinese men who are in some sort of positions of holding national secrets, whether, you know, works for the Chinese government or for certain tech company, for military units. Usually those people are men.
You said that this story does not surprise you because there have been others like it before. Does anything about the reaction or how this is landing today surprise you?
Well, I think the criticism towards the university's decision to expel her is also very strong. So criticizing the university being sexist, misogynistic, nationalistic. So this signals a high degree of women's rights awareness. So I'm pleased to see that. Yes, there's a lot of nationalistic, sexist trolls against the women, but also there are a lot of criticism towards the university. So that is a positive trend.
Yacho Wang is a Chinese human rights researcher based in Washington. When you're going through a tough time, it can help to call someone you trust, but that's not always an option. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on a new book that takes inspiration from a historic helpline that filled the need for one particular community.
Elizabeth Lovett was rummaging around a library archive in London when she came across a pretty standard, unremarkable notebook.
It's really plain. It's just an A4 black notebook.
Upon closer inspection, though, the cover had handwritten clues to what lay inside.
The dates are on it, and someone else had written kind of old on it and doodled around the corners and things.
The seemingly mundane notebook ended up being a treasure trove to Lovett. It's a logbook from the 90s used by volunteers of a London-based helpline called the Lesbian Line. It was for lesbians and by lesbians.
It's just an incredible document. There are all these kind of very short handwritten entries. Normally they have their date, their name maybe, and kind of a summary of the phone call that they'd had. Maybe sometimes direct quotes, but often not.
The logbook gave Lovett a clear picture of what callers were talking and wondering about at the time. Some wanted help with coming out to family. Others wanted to know where to find lesbian friends. Lovett was surprised to read about the large number of women engaged or married to men who called in.
Sort of saying, I'm actually gay and I don't want to do this.
Lovett recognized that this isn't ancient history. It's from a mere 30 years ago. But sitting in an archive, the stories were at risk of being forgotten.
And so it really felt like our history was not going to get captured unless somebody wrote about it and is going to do it by lesbians.
Lovett took on the task herself and wrote, "Thank you for calling the Lesbian Line," published in May. To protect callers' privacy, she fictionalized the entries, though each is rooted in real logbook notes.
All the stories in the book are true and honest stories, but they're not the real stories, if that makes sense. And that was just a way to kind of bring them to life and to have their voices present.
Lovett also tells her own coming out story in the book and dives into the broader history of the helpline, including the more painful parts, like the Lesbian Line's response to transgender callers. Some volunteers felt trans lesbians should be able to call the line. Others did not. "It's a history I have to reckon with myself," she writes. The vast majority of the stories, though, are full of earnest care and attention. And Lovett says the volunteers of the Lesbian Line she spoke with are happy to have their stories told.
I think especially for older lesbians to know that young people are interested in this history as well. Actually, whenever I speak to younger people, they're kind of craving this history. It's not stuff that you find out maybe at school or in a museum or even through your own family history. You kind of have to seek out queer history yourself.
The Lesbian Line that Lovett writes about was one of a handful of helplines specifically for queer women that ran in Europe and North America from the 70s to the early 2000s. Since then, they've all been folded into bigger helplines that serve the wider LGBTQ community. Lovett hopes her book will not only spread this one slice of history, but also inspire people to write their own records for future generations to find and learn from. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Brother Ali is a rapper who became popular in the early 2000s for his hard-hitting critique of racism and inequality in the U.S. He had a particular knack for mixing the personal and the political. 2 decades later, the rapper moved to Turkey on a spiritual journey as a Muslim. These days, Brother Ali says his political views are making it hard to get his music out there. Reporter Fariba Nawa met up with him in Istanbul to hear his story.
Brother Ali tells me to meet him at a little-known 16th-century mosque on a hill. He comes here to pray every day. Today he's wearing a fez hat and tunic. We sit on the steps outside the prayer hall. This is not just any mosque for him. It's named after a Sufi saint, Aziz Mahmud Hodai. The saint's grave is next to the mosque.
So the reason I come to Aziz Mahmud is because, like, that man that's buried right there, he was close to the sultan that built the Blue Mosque. And he told the truth to the sultan.
Ali reveres the saint. He stood for justice and truth as a confidant of the Ottoman ruler. Those values are integral to Ali's rap music and life.
Your virtue never dies. Your money comes and goes. Your freedom comes and goes. Your life just goes.
I got red eyes and one of them's lazy. And they both squint when the sun shines, so I look crazy. I'm albino, man. I know I'm pink and pale. And I'm hairy as hell everywhere but fingernails.
Ali was born Jason Douglas Newman in 1977 with a rare genetic condition characterized by a deficiency of melanin in the skin, hair, and eyes. Ali's cotton-pale skin, light eyes, and low vision made him a target for bullying in school.
So I always say that the beginning of my life and work and identity and career and everything has to do with the fact that I'm albino, I have albinism.
Ali grew up in the upper Midwest in a broken family with addiction issues. His mother died young, and his father took his own life.
I thought that I would never be part of a society at all. Really, when I was a little kid, I thought I would never have friends, I would never be part of anything.
Ali is white, but it was in the black community in Minneapolis where he found acceptance. At the age of 7, he realized he could captivate black family gatherings by dancing and telling stories. There he found his love for hip-hop and the roots of its pain.
And I already had so much anger and rage about racism in America just from being around my friends and seeing even the way that my family, who wasn't overtly racist, but the way that they thought about black people that I couldn't put into words.
Ali went to church but never connected with Christianity. Hip-hop led him to Islam.
Best believe the Quran influenced all of my songs. My friends running tattoo them all on their arms. When I travel, be there every time I perform. Now look me in the eye and tell me how am I wrong. And who would have
he discovered black Muslim activists and studied leaders like the late Malcolm X, who's one of his heroes. Ali converted when he was 15 years old and changed his name. He says there are many reasons why he was attracted to the faith.
I would say the biggest one is because I believed it then and I believe it now that it's a true universal religion. And it can be expressed in so many different ways.
Religion plays a huge role in his music.
The Quran says speak out for justice even if it's against yourself and your people. And all of the causes that I speak about are self-critique.
Come on now. Smoke and mirrors, stripes and stars. Stoning for the cross in the name of God. Bloodshed, genocide, rape and fraud. Written to the pages of the law, good law.
Ali rose to stardom with his album Shadows in the Sun, released in 2003. The lyrics are self-reflective, delving into themes of identity and social justice. He became a YouTube sensation, invited to appear on late-night talk shows in the U.S. His fans love his uncensored critique of U.S. imperialism, racism, and inequality. But the 2007 controversial hit song, Uncle Sam God, made him a target for U.S. law enforcement. His sponsor, Verizon, canceled his tour.
It's interesting because it is my most popular song. It's also the song that's given me the most trouble. I've been on government watch lists for years. I've never been associated with anything violent. I have no criminal record. I've been arrested one time in my life, and it was for civil disobedience.
Ali was detained for protesting against wrongful home foreclosures in 2012. His activism bore fruit. The Occupy Homes movement he was part of resulted in a law that protects homeowners from foreclosures in Minnesota. After the song Uncle Sam was released, border agents have been interrogating Ali almost every time he enters the U.S. His wife and kids have also been questioned. Sohail Dawlatzai is a scholar exploring the nexus of race, culture, and politics at UC Irvine. He's been following Ali's work for decades. I asked Dawlatzai what he thinks of Ali's critics who accuse him of being anti-American.
I think anti-American, like other words that get used, and word, like anti-Semitism, they're essentially just cudgels and hammers that end up silencing conversation as opposed to opening up the conversation and listening to what artists and writers and thinkers that Brother Ali is a part of, are actually saying.
Ali thought life might become easier in Turkey. One of Ali's other passions is Islamic history, and part of what led him to move to an ancient city like Istanbul 4 years ago during the pandemic. It was his wife's idea to live here with their four children as an extension of their spiritual journey. Ali's been married for 23 years and says he trusts his wife's instincts. They settled in Üsküdar, a religious neighborhood.
We're religious foreigners. So the people that are like deeply secular and nationalist, we're the exact people that they don't want to be here. But they're still polite to us. They're still good to us.
Ali was used to being recognized in Minneapolis, but it's humbling to be anonymous here, he says. He says he wants to be buried in Turkey. Ali doesn't address censorship and human rights in Turkey. He says in his music, he's critical of the communities he's from. He's just a guest here. Still, Ali's learning Turkish, producing rap songs and a podcast. His latest album, Satisfied Soul, was released in February. Yet once again, Ali says the music industry is sidelining him, this time for his pro-Palestinian views.
Last year, I made an album with an anti-Zionist Jewish producer named Unjust. We had a song called The Collapse, which was about the empire, and it was specifically talking about Gaza. I went a full year without a single paid show.
Ali usually performs 150 paid shows a year worldwide. He believes he lost all these gigs because of his political views. The financial setback stings, but Ali says he'll continue to speak out against injustice because that's what a true Muslim does. For the world, I'm Fariba Nawa, Istanbul. When the time turns timeless, the meek finally speak. Oppressors beg the fire to cease. The hearts go blind as though the eyes go to sleep. And we peeping. The fools that you're seeing, that's you in that museum. Can you feel it? Everyone can
dance. Say you're a pianist whose ability to play just disappeared overnight. That actually happened to Ricardo Baldini in Canada. One morning, 6 years ago, he woke up paralyzed from the waist down. A cluster of blood vessels had burst. He could still use his hands, but as a concert pianist, he also needed to be able to use the pedals with his feet. So Baldini worked with engineers to create a tool that lets him control the foot pedals with his mouth. And Baldini has just used it to play three performances with the Edmonton Symphony Orchestra.
It's been a dream come true for me, being able to perform with a full symphony orchestra after my injury.
Baldini and his team designed the new tools for pianos, but he sees potential for other things too, like sewing machines and pottery wheels. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Felix Baumgartner became a household name in 2012. That's when he jumped out of what looked like a space capsule hovering in the stratosphere with nothing but a parachute to stop his fall.
And there you can see by the approaching shadow, he's just about there, and he's down on the earth safely back.
He hurtled more than 24 miles to the ground and broke the sound barrier with his own body, a first in skydiving. Baumgartner died yesterday while paragliding in Italy. We wanted to better understand what motivates extreme athletes when the risk of what they do, however remote, is often death. I spoke earlier today with Odette Hornby, a sports psychologist at the University of South Wales in Cardiff.
There is no one reason why many of these people do these sports, and the actual motivations for continuing and participating are often multifaceted. Many of the core reasons come down to sort of the connections they make with the people that are doing it, and actually being able to understand each other and understand the risks that they're taking. But also some of the really core concepts go down to things named alexithymia and anhedonia. So alexithymia being is a personality trait where someone has difficulty identifying and describing their emotions. Anhedonia is the concept that normal day-to-day activities are less exciting. Extreme sports people are often attracted to things where there is an increased risk because it allows them to feel and experience emotions like somebody who would be able to go for a walk and say, that was nice, I enjoyed that, I feel happy. Whereas for these individuals, actually taking part in something that has a higher level of risk is what allows them to feel and actually identify and describe that feeling.
Okay, so there's two things going on here. One is feeling the emotion, the other is identifying and talking about it. And,
yes,
and both
yeah,
of those
exactly
things
that.
Drive people to do these extreme sports and get these big thrills.
Yeah, and it goes down to that emotion regulation, which allows these individuals to actually manage the emotions they feel, especially in circumstances where fear and risk are inevitable. Being able to manage the feelings that come with that is really important.
So are all or most of the people who are pursuing extreme sports, do they have these traits, or do some people just like the thrill?
A bit of both. I think what's quite important to note is that in the research that I've done, actually the thrills and the risk were not the key motivators. It's actually about mitigating risk and doing something that brings them different emotions to everyday life.
Is there something actually different about these people's brain chemistry that makes them pursue these sports?
So some of the research has looked into things like their genes and how actually their DNA is different from birth. And I'm sure lots of people have watched the Free Solo film where they've looked at Alex Honnold's brain scans, mm-hmm. and the amygdala is actually different. And therefore, the fear he feels is very different to what someone else may feel on a day-to-day activity. It takes him a free solo climb to actually even get that same level of fear.
And free solo is climbing without ropes on his own. So it's just
yes,
about the riskiest
yeah.
kind of climbing you can do. We actually have a clip of Alex Honnold speaking. He scaled El Capitan in Yosemite, like I said, without ropes. And he said this about climbing without ropes versus climbing with them.
Free soloing plays out more in the mind. The physical effort is largely the same. Your body is still climbing the same wall. But staying calm and performing at your best when you know that any mistake could mean death requires a certain kind of mindset.
What is that mindset that he's talking about?
It's the mindset that they have to know that every move they make could lead to severe injury or death. So they are having to remain completely composed and calm under immense amounts of pressure.
Did you talk with any of these extreme athletes about their perception of death?
I briefly touched on it because many of them that I had spoken to, or a few of them at least, had lost friends in sports. So they were quite aware of the possibility that that could be.
And do they have a different perception of death or weigh the risks of death differently than maybe those of us watching them perform their feats?
Absolutely. I think the key difference is that for them, extreme sports for them are controllable. So something that I found really, really interesting in the interviews that I had with them is that every single one of them told me that driving a car and getting on the roads for them seemed more risky because they didn't know who else was on the road, whether they drank alcohol, whether they were under the influence of drugs. And therefore, for them, actually engaging in extreme sports, which they trained probably 20 plus years to do, that was a lot less risky than something that a lot of us would do on a daily basis.
It sounds like a matter of control.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
What do you see as the biggest misperception that the public has about the people who are driven to extreme sports?
I think the biggest misconception is that the media portray these people as real adrenaline junkies who are not really, really meticulous in planning. Having spoken to some of the top level extreme athletes, they are some of the nicest people who are not taking part to be reckless. They've spent absolutely years training to do something that takes a lot of skill, and actually they spend a lot of time really training and nailing that down.
Odette Hornby is a sports psychologist at the University of South Wales. She joined us from Cardiff. Soccer is the most watched sport in the world. There are clubs and leagues for just about every kind of fan. But there's a new take on soccer that may not have widespread appeal. Organizers call the matches freedom kicks. Some people love them. Others say they're a kick in the face, literally. The World's Jerry Haddon brings us this dispatch from the Spanish town of Moya.
Normally in soccer, it's one team against the other, with each side bent on scoring goals. But at these matches, it's the kicking itself that counts. In today's match, it's everyone against Franco, says local organizer Eulald Pla. Pla's referring to the late dictator General Francisco Franco, who ruled Spain for decades until his death 50 years ago. It's Franco's head that's rolling today, or rather a replica of it, getting kicked around in a muddy meadow at the opening of an alternative arts festival here called Ex Abrupto. The latex Franco head, created by Spanish artist Eugenio Merino, is overly large, but it does look exactly like the general. The big ears, the jowls and slightly hooked nose, even the wispy gray hair and mustache.
With the human head, you can touch the material. It's very, very important, because this epic, realistic figure can transport to the fight.
The fight against forgetting Franco's victims, says Marc Escarrobil, a young player who's just come off the pitch to catch his breath.
You can express your hunger, you can express your feelings about love for your family that lost during this period.
You can express your anger.
Yes, so, at the same time, it's healthy for your soul.
Escarrobil watches on under a rainy, thundering sky as Franco's hair becomes caked with mud, his cheeks stained by grass. It's much harder to control a head than a ball with your foot, and the match is complete chaos. But the event itself is highly choreographed.
I'll call it, yeah, from here. And then once they get into position, whistle and play.
Okay.
And talk to them about playing loud.
This was the moment just before the match started. An artist from an American collective called In Decline directs the action and films. In Decline describes itself as rebel artists taking on global injustice. Wherever they go, they aim to provoke. This is their freedom kick on the Mexican side of the border with the U.S. The goalposts are painted onto the high border fence. The human head, that of U.S. President Donald Trump. In Brazil, it was former President Jair Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro is currently on trial for allegedly trying to stage a coup after losing elections in 2022. And in Munich, In Decline reached back to the late 19th century, choosing Otto von Bismarck, the unifier of modern Germany. Bismarck is lesser known for having helped carve up Africa into colonial spheres of influence, destroying cultures and nations along the way. During the Franco freedom kick in Spain, the young artist from In Decline says he's too busy directing the show to talk. Later, I reach out to In Decline by email, but still haven't heard back. But Eulal Pla, the local organizer, explains why this group of about 40 people went to the trouble to play human head soccer in a thunderstorm. We and In Decline, we like art that provokes critical thinking, he says, not just thinking. It's interesting, he says, to use soccer as a tool to discuss taboos. For decades, that taboo in Spain was talking about the victims of Franco's repression during the Civil War and after. But some Spaniards, like Ima Garmendia from Barcelona, say that chapter in Spanish history is long over.
Un partido con la cabeza de Franco como balón me da bastante igual.
I could care less if someone plays soccer with Franco's head, she says. It just seems outdated. It'd make more sense to do that, say, with Benjamin Netanyahu, she says. At this point, Franco is water under the bridge. Garmendia acknowledges that that might not be the case for family members of Franco's victims, many of whom still have relatives in mass graves. These days, investigators are actively searching for those dead, digging them up and letting families lay them to rest properly. So what's In Decline ultimately after? To honor the dead through acts of symbolic violence, to draw attention to injustice, or just to provoke for provoking's sake? In the end, says Eulal Pla, each of us has to interpret for ourselves the message in all of this. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Moya, Spain.
The Britpop band Oasis is doing a reunion tour in the UK. It is a big deal. The band has not performed together on stage for 15 years, but many thousands of fans can't afford to see them because scalpers, or ticket touts as they are called in the UK, have sent ticket prices through the roof. The British government is promising new policies to change that, but as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports, it may not be so simple.
Champagne. 80,000 people packed into an arena in Manchester last weekend to watch Oasis play their first hometown gig in years. This video, though, is of hundreds of fans outside the venue who couldn't get their hands on tickets. As the Oasis tour continues, fans have taken to TikTok to vent.
If I see someone selling Oasis tickets, not these little scammers, we will remortgage the house because we are going.
We still have no Oasis tickets, and I know it seems silly to cry over that, but I've been messaged by about 10 million scammers, and I did the only sane thing that I could think of, and I messaged Noel and Liam and Oasis. I'm going to tag them in this video, and I've tried literally everything.
When tickets first went on sale last August, they sold out in under 10 hours. But just a couple of hours later, they popped up on resale websites like Viagogo, selling, in some cases, for more than $8,000. That's 40 times their face value. It caused such an uproar in Britain, the Prime Minister Keir Starmer himself brought it up in Parliament.
It's great that Oasis are back together. I think, from what I've determined, about half the country is probably queuing for tickets over the weekend. But it is depressing to hear of price hikes.
Starmer promised a consultation process to investigate how to put an end to the mess. Reg Walker, a security consultant and expert on ticketing, says scalpers, or touts as we call them in Europe, have created software that allows them to jump the queue the moment tickets go for sale online.
Now, the equivalent is, if you're standing at the window of a box office outside a venue, waiting for tickets to go on sale at 9:01, and you are first in the queue, we've seen instances where the cyber effect is 800,000 people then push in front of you.
Reselling concert tickets for crazy prices isn't illegal in Britain, but the government is now considering new laws that would cap resale prices and hit scalpers with hefty fines. In Ireland, tickets can only be resold at face value under laws introduced back in 2021.
The legislation was good. It does work. There's been a massive drop in ticket touting. I mean, it's fallen off a cliff.
I decide to test it out myself and try and buy tickets for Billie Eilish. She's playing a couple of nights at the Three Arena in Dublin this month. The tickets are €103.25. That's around $120. And they're sold out both nights. Okay, let me go and see if I can find tickets for Billie Eilish playing in Dublin. And there is a website, SeatsNet Marketplace. Here we go. Tickets are available for €424. That's around $492.
I think the issue with the Irish legislation was it didn't make the legislation supranational. So in effect in Ireland, whilst you can't tout tickets in Ireland itself, you can sit offshore. Technically, you could sit in the UK or even in Northern Ireland and resell tickets at inflated prices for face value in the Republic of Ireland.
Walker says if the UK government introduces new laws, they have to be supranational to stop the touts operating from overseas. Resale websites like Viagogo say if they can't resell tickets at a profit, the scalpers will just move elsewhere, like onto social media. Rolling Stone journalist Nick Riley says that's already happening. He did an experiment on the platform X recently.
I tweeted, I was like, has anyone got tickets for Oasis at Nebworth, which happened in 1996, so almost 30 years ago. And lo and behold, these bots were saying, yep, I've got tickets to a gig that happened 30-odd years ago. And I've done it with musicians who are no longer with us. I tweeted before and said, has anyone got tickets to the Jimi Hendrix and Prince show? And lo and behold, these bots responded and said, yes, I have.
Rule of thumb, Riley says, if it seems too good to be true, it almost always is. And if all else fails, you can always join the fans outside the grounds at Heaton Park in Manchester. For the world, I'm Orla Barry.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It all started at an independent bookstore just outside Copenhagen, the Danish capital, a few months back. 5 boxes of books arrived from a publisher in the U.S. The only problem was the books were supposed to end up in Kenya.
The publisher decided that it was too much hassle to try to ship them on. They would ship a new shipment to Nairobi, and we could keep the books.
That's Isabella Musavizadeh Smith. She owns the Copenhagen bookstore Books & Company. She told me recently she's putting those books to good use.
Well, our first thought was maybe we could just figure out who we could donate them to. Maybe someone would be interested in them. And then we thought about it for a while, and then we decided that these books, although we've had some of the books featured in our store before, we've had them in the store, these were not books that we would normally have. And why shouldn't we take the opportunity to showcase books that were ordered for bookstores so far away from us and that reflected a different country, a different city, a different culture than the one that we were in? And I have an international bookstore, and although all my books are in English, we do try to represent as many cultures and countries as possible in translation. And I just realized that I really have not been good enough at curating books from African countries. And we do try to have as wide and diverse a curation as possible. But for a small independent bookstore, there are obviously limitations. And this was a perfect opportunity to show books that we don't normally have.
Yeah. How exactly was this selection of books different from what you usually sell? Were there more African authors in it, or were the topics different?
All bar just a couple of them were African authors and or about Africa. So there was a lot of fiction by African authors, but there was also nonfiction. It seemed to be two groups, fiction by well-known authors. I will say I knew all the authors. So it's authors like Abdulrazak Gurna, who was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2021, or the author Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who is Kenyan, and who actually passed away just days after we did our display.
Yeah.
And who is actually very well known for writing in native African languages and being very much a promoter of doing that. After having started by writing in English, he changed to writing primarily in Gikuyu. And so these were, it seemed to me, books that really wanted to promote African culture, and the nonfiction were books that really wanted to promote African history.
So you've created a window display with a lot of these titles. What kind of response have you gotten from your readers, from your buyers?
I mean, I opened my bookstore 16 years ago, and this has been one of the best experiences we've ever had. People have just reacted so positively and so well to being introduced to books that they didn't know or hadn't thought of reading. And we've had people come in asking us what this was. And just by looking at it and just by seeing, we'd written Chance Encounter with a Nairobi bookshop on our window. And people just came in and were just fascinated by that. And just the mere act of doing that made people look at the books, pick up the books, think about somewhere so far away and a continent that honestly in Europe, we don't talk enough about or know enough about. And we've also had people from Nairobi come in. Obviously, there it says Nairobi on the window in a small bookshop outside Copenhagen. And they walk in and they were thrilled. They were thrilled to see themselves reflected in a bookstore window and their culture and their country. So it's been such a positive story for us. And one of the follow-ups has really been that people have asked if I would do more window displays like that. And we're considering reaching out to small bookstores, independent bookstores in African countries or in India or China, places that are far away from us to see if maybe we could do some kind of collaboration.
This chance accidental shipment might turn into kind of a reading list swap with other bookshops around the world.
I mean, wouldn't that be the best? I would love that. That would be so great.
And if this were a rom-com, there would also be a romance somehow entwined in this story.
Oh, yes. That would be wonderful. And we could write our own book about it.
So you said these titles are maybe not well represented on your shelves. Do you mostly stock books in English by American and British authors? Or is there a wider diversity there and just not so much from Africa specifically?
As I mentioned, we've had a lot of these authors, their books in the store in the past, but maybe not as many as we would like and maybe not as varied as we would like. I can only speak for Europe and my country. And we look towards the UK and the US for literature. And it's just so much a part of our reading culture. And I think a lot of people feel that that's so accessible. It's something they know. It's easy to go to. Whereas books that are maybe from African countries or Asian countries, although there are obviously trends like Japanese literature and Korean literature, which is huge right now. But otherwise, in general, we don't look beyond that, beyond Europe or beyond the UK and US. And I think we should be doing more of that. Mm. We need more communication. We need to understand each other better in this world instead of, you know, siloing ourselves the way we are doing right now. I think it would be beneficial for everyone.
You said you've gotten a positive response from customers, what they're saying, at least. Are the books selling well?
They are. And we've had so many requests for more books from African countries. And people just want us to curate more in that direction. And we would love to do that. And I've even had universities, schools, libraries contact me and say, you know, if you have any of these books left over, could we please buy them or could you donate them to us? So this is all coming from these accidental five boxes that arrived.
And one Instagram post, right?
And one Instagram post and my newsletter. That's it.
You said that there's a real focus on American and British literature. I wonder if that's because that's what people are familiar with and will buy, or I wonder if that is kind of a bias from booksellers such as yourself as well.
I think it is definitely a bias from booksellers. Because I am a small independent bookstore, I really try to have a lot of debut authors, a lot of smaller authors. I work with a lot of small and large publishers directly to be able to access new literature that comes out. So we're not all selling the same stuff. But even with that, I think we are all guilty of some bias. And it's also what I read the most. It's what my colleagues read the most. And so we really need to work hard at getting out and seeing other things.
Isabella Musaviza de Smith is the owner of Books and Company outside of Copenhagen, Denmark. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Search for The World News GBH, that is all one word, and be sure to subscribe. I'm Carolyn Buehler. Have a fantastic weekend and join us right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Sherry Mallon and Jonathan Abbott, Paula and Cy DeCoste, William Reynolds, Carolyn Talcott, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.